For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with a thank you to Columbus, Ohio, which is number 39 on our list of cities for top CDN views, and a thank you to all our new YouTube subscribers. We made a pitch for 20,000 new subscribers to get us to 100,000, and as of this filming, we're already at 97. So welcome aboard, and if you're watching and haven't subscribed, please do, because it helps us get the word out and avoid deplatforming. And now, a big no thank you to Justin Trudeau, Canada's Prime Minister, who apparently believes that our country not only stinks, but is on fire. It seems that alarmists are all done with evidence-based decision-making here. Thus, on May 16th, responding to Federal Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre seeking a summer holiday from Trudeau's carbon tax for Canadian drivers, the Prime Minister snarled, and I quote, "The country is burning," end quote. And he added, for bad measure, that his partisan adversary, quote, "would rather watch the country burn and Canadians suffer than continue to fight against climate change," end quote. What a bad man. Especially since you'd think that someone who flew in his government jet 20 times in the month of May alone, spewing carbon dioxide in enormous quantities, might be ever so slightly reticent about haranguing Canadians for wanting a summer car trip. Not at all. And Trudeau's Health Minister Mark Holland, having himself flown back and forth across the country quite a bit lately, ranted that such holiday outings amounted to forcing kids to endure 10 hours in a vehicle with no bathroom break, just, quote, "to let the planet burn," end quote. But the planet is not burning, and neither is Canada. The slightly less untethered state-funded CBC limited itself to hectoring back in April that, quote, "the federal government says Canada could face another destructive wildfire season because of an unusually warm winter, widespread drought conditions, and a forecast of above-normal temperatures in the months ahead," end quote. But once again, the notion that something could happen isn't very interesting or useful, especially if, say, you happen to live on a planet where there are roughly 70,000 wildfires a year. And that's a number that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency shows is declining before trying to blame an increase in wildfires on relentless global warming, because the largest area burned on record was in 2015, nearly a decade ago. And after conceding that, quote, "despite California's inferno, global wildfires are fizzling out," end quote, and then blaming climate change anyway, The Economist howled, quote, "Canadians are taking dramatic steps to avoid more ruinous firestorms," end quote. Firestorms? Isn't that a word more often used of, say, Dresden or Tokyo in 1945? But this is 2024 and the media are ablaze. By the fourth paragraph, those fires had mutated into, and I quote again, "alien monsters," end quote. But luckily, The Economist says, quote, "Canada's fire services are mustering drones that drop dragon egg bombs, summoning the long-ignored wisdom of Indigenous peoples and heeding the ancient counsel of an admonishing cartoon bear. That means relying on mitigation and preparation rather than mere suppression to deal with firestorms that many fear are Canada's new normal," end quote. Canada's new normal is that the country is not on fire, as usual, but it does have wildfires, as usual. However, welcome to the new stupid, because the land certainly is ablaze with that. Oh, and from the Now You Tell Us file, The Atlantic Weekly Planet suddenly admits that, quote, "no one really understands clouds. They're one of the greatest climate mysteries left," end quote. Gosh. Are they now? Because they're really important to patterns of warming and cooling, so if they're doing something we don't understand and it's important, then CO2 isn't the main issue and the science isn't settled, which is kind of important to the story. Now, that piece really is a giant step forward, at least in admitting things already known to those who follow the science rather than the science. It quotes an atmospheric scientist from the University of Chicago that, quote, "clouds remain one of the least understood or least reliably predictable factors in our climate models. They are among the biggest uncertainties in predicting future climate change," unquote. Uncertainties in predicting climate change? And here you all seemed so certain. We've been given predictions of temperature in the year 2100 to fractions of a degree if we do, or do not, meet our Paris Accord commitments. We've been assured the models are vindicated and the debate is over. Year after year, decade after decade, it ends. And now, you admit that water vapor has you baffled and it's not the only thing? Perhaps we should not jeer, because driving people back into their mental trenches isn't the best way to foster a more productive and open debate. But we have been taking abuse for decades for claiming this kind of thing, including specifically about clouds and water vapor, and so we do want some acknowledgement that we were... what's that word? Right. Meanwhile, continuing to draw on the work of Ottawa Weather Records without making any implication that its creator agrees with our interpretation of the data that he unearths, we also hear that in Canada's capital, May 31st was, quote, Ottawa's 31st consecutive day with maximum temperature above 14 degrees Celsius. This is the longest run before June 1st in more than 20 years, since May 31st, 1998, end quote. Which sounds like a warming trend, whatever 1998 was up to, except that, as usual, he publishes a chart ranking the top 10 such runs. And while 1998 is indeed in second, 2024 is sixth, and the reason that it's still the longest run in more than 20 years is because fifth to third were way more than 20 years ago. 1887, 1896, and 1975. And meanwhile, the top spot is held by 1921, more than a century ago. You see, if you're not cherry-picking scary-looking temperature trends, what you get from the actual record looks a lot more like natural variability. Ah, and from the oh shut up file, Scientific American has the gall to say, quote, Antarctica's doomsday glacier is melting even faster than scientists thought, end quote. Yes, again. So, if you won't shut up, then we do wish that you'd tell us how many times scientists have to say the glacier is melting even faster than scientists thought before scientists start to think that it's melting as fast as scientists say they think it is. And, for bonus points, how many times does it have to be melting faster than fast before it actually melts? Inquiring penguins want to know. Then, from the One Rule for Me file, social media entrepreneur, climate activist, and general annoyance Mark Zuckerberg has a new yacht. And when you hear the word yacht, please do not think small bucolic sailing vessel with two-bed cabin. We're talking about a 387-foot diesel-powered behemoth that still can't rival the yacht of online entrepreneur and climate activist scold Jeff Bezos. And from the law of unintended consequences, Canary Media chirps that, quote, Vermont is on the cusp of mandating 100% clean electricity by 2035. The state Senate approved the measure this week, putting Vermont on track to be among the first states to fully decarbonize its power grid, end quote. And here, need we really mention again that what politicians say will happen because of a piece of legislation and what really does happen because of it are not always exactly the same? Apparently we do, especially since the piece adds, quote, advocates involved with the Vermont bill's passage told Canary Media that the new standard would underpin parallel climate efforts, like the state's bid to electrify its home heating sector, end quote. So, a measure to limit the state's access to electric power can be implemented alongside another measure that requires more electric power to be available, and they will work together? What's more, and again, it's from the piece, quote, the targets are far from an about-face for Vermont. Nearly all the electricity it generates in-state has come from renewable sources since 2015. But Vermont imports over half its power, including some fossil fuel-generated electricity, end quote. So, the good news here is that a state that already can't cover its energy needs from these fabled renewables is planning to increase its need for them while eliminating its backup option. What could possibly go wrong? And then, from our bulging on climate you can say just anything file, New York Times columnist David Gellies says, quote, thanks to the rapid build-out of wind and solar power plants, particularly in China, global emissions from the power sector are set to decline this year, end quote. Right. The same China that emitted between about 13 and 16 gigatons of greenhouse gases in 2023 figures very mysteriously on this point, and we should add that China's official statistics on almost anything are worthless. Even so, It's clearly producing nearly triple the United States, which is in second place, and China began construction on 70 gigawatts of new coal-powered electric plants in 2023 alone. They are so totally decreasing emissions. Sure thing, buddy. On a slightly more positive note, a correspondent recently sent us a poster, quote, "A Rough Guide to Spotting Bad Science," end quote, that we found helpful in stepping back from current controversies that present a persistent temptation to, quote, "cast a covetous eye on the outcome," end quote, in Kierkegaard's apt and haunting phrase. Because when you're involved in an argument, you do risk looking at data and lines of argument based on where you think they're going to take you in the heat of the moment. But surely, on calm reflection, all of us really want to go wherever the truth lies, even if it might mean we have to admit we were wrong in some regard. So, that poster from a site called Compound Interest, and it was posted back in 2014, says that bad science involves, quote, 1, sensationalized headlines, 2, misinterpreted results, 3, conflicts of interest, 4, correlation and causation, 5, unsupported conclusions, 6, problems with sample size, 7, unrepresentative samples used, 8, no control group used, 9, no blind testing used, 10, selective reporting of data, 11, unreplicable results, 12, non-peer-reviewed material, end quote. And we present them to you even though, in fact, we think number 12 is itself bad science, given the extraordinary flood of evidence lately that peer review is deeply, even fatally flawed, despite which climate alarmists are, or were, very fond of insisting that it was a silver bullet. For our part, we'd prefer to substitute as number 12 in the red flag list, quote, argument from authority, end quote, where people try to exclude a point of view or data set because it didn't come from their kind of people. But the rest do seem to us to be very important errors and very common ones, including among climate alarmists. Just look at what they do with tree rings. And if we can all agree in principle that these kinds of things are undesirable, it might help us debate calmly and intelligently which ones are currently on display in any given argument, including the one over climate, and who's displaying them. In this week's newsletter, we conclude our series on Martin Durkin's Climate the Movie by saying again that if you haven't yet watched it, you should, and then recommending, for a two-minute version, a 1982 CBS News item that was unearthed by Tony Heller, which contains everything that the movie rebuts, from unnamed legions of the scientists pronouncing authoritatively on the impending disaster, to a warning that 40% of Florida will be underwater on an unspecified timetable, and then a cartoon explanation of the supposedly simple physics, followed by, oh yeah, Al Gore, then a junior congressman, citing these scientists who are so alarmed to start demanding money for the cause. Now, to be fair, the graphics in the scare are getting better, but the science isn't, and the predictions are actually getting worse. And then, further to our quest for positivity, with barbecue season upon us, we offer CDN readers and viewers a word in defense of hamburgers, steaks, roasts, ribs, briskets, ideally grilled slowly over smoking hardwood, and all the other mouth-watering delights that come to us by way of our bovine friends. True, they may be making your waist expand, they may be doing who knows what to your cholesterol, or maybe they're the secret to better health and weight loss. Who knows? The science there is not settled. But what we do know is they're not wrecking the climate. And here we offer two pieces of evidence for you to munch on, or three if you count the one where we say, hey, you think we should eat bugs? You go first. Second, the beef about cattle is that they eat grass and then burp methane, and worse, as they digest it. And yes, methane is a greenhouse gas. But as, again, Tony Heller noted back in 2021, there are currently about as many cattle in the US as there once were bison, which are also methane-emitting ruminants. That home where the buffalo roam contained as many as 100 million of them until the 19th century. But those vast herds didn't prevent the natural little ice age from occurring, the coldest interval in the Northern Hemisphere in the last 10,000 years. And here we have shades of the alarmist insistence that nature responds differently to man-made than to natural CO2, we know at the risk of uttering a discouraging word. And the third thing we bring up is that Francis Menton, also known as the Manhattan Contrarian, recently highlighted a new study questioning whether cattle are even a net contributor to methane levels. Yes, the study said methane does come from grass breaking down in cows' guts. But if they didn't eat the grass, it would still die and be broken down by bacterial action, which also releases, methane. So we say happy grilling of beef or bison, or if you're a rich alarmist nagging celebrity, a grasshopper steak. On which topic? From the CO2science.org archive. Supposedly, each methane molecule has a global warming potential about 21 times greater than that of a CO2 molecule. At any event, that's what this paper said, though we've seen a surprisingly inconsistent range of numbers. But anyway, this paper in 2004 looked at existing and proposed ways of reducing methane emissions from dairy cows. And what it comes down to is, if you really care about that stuff, try feeding the cows a better diet, since it's probably a better idea anyway. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I don't see any flames outside my window.